Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio, another live version, 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, September the 16th, 2016. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening there. Digby, where are you? Oh, there you are, Digby. Sorry.
No problem. Universal time, it is 1 o'clock in the morning, September the 17th, 2016, so you are listening to us live. And that means come on over to our astronomy.fm chat room. That's where all of the action is happening right now. We've got several people in there. I can't, but my computer is kind of locking up.
Okay, so we have Optronics, Glenn T, Starstorm, Twisted Edge, ourselves. We had Night Vision Links in a little bit earlier, but he listens to the podcast from Northern Ireland. So, hiya, Night Vision Links. Glad you could enjoy the podcast. Shame you can't be with us. And I'm going to say this because I'm going to start getting to the habit of saying it at the beginning of the show. After the show is over, the links will be in the show notes on the astronomy.fm website. So if you're listening to the podcast and you're having a problem with wondering what the heck we're looking at, go to the website, look at the show notes. The podcast will be there as soon as our wonderful program director, Rob, can get it there for us. And then you can just follow the links and enjoy what we were doing.
But I do want to say also there's more than one astronomy.fm website, so make sure you get the right one. I've got one I started a long time ago, and then Richie did another one. But that's where most of the stuff is, the one Richie started. So go ahead to the other one. You'll see all the recent posts there. Mine hasn't been had any posts on for quite a while. So
you'll see all the previous show notes, not only from the Event Horizon, but from Comet Watch as well. And just to let you folks know, we are recording a new Comet Watch this Sunday. And we're going back down under, and we're going to have some fun with the history of comet observing.
And the history of comets?
Yeah. We're going to be covering it. We've got some of our good friends. We've got Justin. We've got Michael from down under joining us. We've got Neil Norman, Mary Spicer, and myself. As I say, this is a recorded show, folks. But as soon as we've got it recorded, it will be uploaded to Rob and Michael here at astronomy.fm. And it will be out. Normally, they put it out for us straight after Space Pirates. So if I can get it up to them Sunday afternoon, good chance you'll be hearing it Wednesday evening in the Eastern time zone. Yep. And, of course, as always, we do use the Under British Skies time slot on the Sunday to repeat it for the Europeans.
Great. So who is the first comet discoverer officially?
Well, I'm waiting to find out because this, from what I understand, we have a chat, little chat room of our own. We don't use the AFM room. Okay. We plan our shows using Facebook chat. And Justin and everybody else has been doing some tremendous research. I've just been looking at it during work. So Mary's doing a piece on female comet discoverers. Justin and Michael and Neil are doing an in-depth biography of people and stuff. And you know what? As ever, you're going to get the shipping forecast of comets. So whatever's in the northern skies, particularly, yes, I know it's going to be very UK-centric, but the information we got there, you can apply to other places in the northern hemisphere. Doesn't just have to be the UK. So listen in, enjoy. The show notes are always up before the podcast and before the show is played on astronomy.fm. So as I say, I know that Marty has Space Pirate show notes up on Facebook. Marty, I think you, me, and Dale need to get together so I can get them up on the AFM website too.
Sound good?
Well, you know what? It's kind of like one-stop shopping. Really.
Let's get them on both AFM websites and
we can Space
Pirate.
As I say, hello, Quiet in the Wood. welcome to the show and welcome to chat. Thank you, Starstorm, for letting me know. She's always there with us every week, and it's thanks to Starstorm's gathering of the links that we actually have the show notes as we do.
There must be one of those those little Wi-Fi antenna things nailed to a tree somewhere out there.
Well, you know what they say, you can't see the trees for the wood.
Now, I'm thinking I'm going to see, let's do a little analysis in the Quiet Wood. I got to say that's probably somebody from the UK.
Yeah, and he's probably a Space Pirates listener.
because we say woods here in the US, not wood.
Yes, but the thing is, who speaks the proper English, Marty?
Well, I said it's probably from the UK. We speak the proper American is what we speak here.
Yeah, you speak American. Oh, that's right. The Queen's English, the proper English, mate.
And that's why I have a English to American dictionary handy just for stuff that you say sometimes.
And I would also recommend getting a Canadian to English dictionary, well, Canadian to American dictionary, and an Australian to English and American dictionary. Ripper.
Definitely.
Oh, dear. Now, according to Quiet
Woods. Toledo. Okay. It's in the Quiet Woods, it's from Toledo, actually.
It's from the Lake Erie area.
Mm-hmm.
So he could be a regular from your show who's under a nom de plume.
Maybe.
Maybe, yes. Can't be Diane because Diane's Diane, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not going to be Tavi or Marlene. Right.
And welcome Black Projects from the UK. That I know is Mark. All right, let's do a quick rundown on what's happening in the sky tonight.
It's full moon. It's the harvest moon.
There is a harvest moon tonight. We need that song, Shine on Harvest Moon.
Yeah, true.
Playing in the background, but I don't have that. So we definitely have a full moon, and there was a penumbral eclipse 6 hours ago, something like that, officially at 19. Yep. Was not available in North or South America. But most of the rest of the world. Now,
British got it, I bet.
Yep. Now, this one was an okay visible bit of penumbral eclipse. A lot of penumbral eclipse, nothing visible at all, because the center of the shadow, or shadow, is called the umbra, and then there's the outer portion, which has a little bit of sunlight mixed in with the shadow, so that's called the penumbral. Now, when the moon goes through the penumbral, most of the time, you cannot detect any darkening in the outer regions of the penumbral shadow. But in the penumbral shadow that's right next to the umbral shadow, it does darken the moon just enough so you can see one edge during mid-eclipse on the moon noticeably darker. Just barely, but definitely noticeably darker. So this one was worth seeing because it did almost hit that umbral edge of the shadow, but just missed it. So this one definitely would have been worth viewing. There was one, how was it, a month ago or 2 months ago, something like that, that it went through the outermost portion of the penumbral shadow. Was not in the least bit visible at all. So this one had a chance. I've already seen some pictures from it that look kind of nice.
Actually, the greatest thing about it is, to me, is the enjoyment of watching the moon change color.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with lunar eclipses, the moon doesn't go dark. It goes to a lovely copper color.
In a full umbral eclipse,
yes. Now, there's actually a scale for this. I'm just trying to quickly Google this for you.
And the difference in darkness is based on the amount of basically dust and dirt in the atmosphere, usually caused from either major fire, forest fires, or from volcanic eruptions. Puts more particles in the atmosphere and allows a less of the red sunlight to be bent around from the backside of the Earth to the atmosphere in the edges of the Earth that actually get to shine on the moon. So when the lead particles, the redder it is and darker it is too.
So I have put a link into the chat room, Lunar Eclipses for Beginners by Fred Espenank.
Espenank?
Espenank. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Potato, potato. Okay. Now, what they have is what they call the I'm trying to pronounce it correctly. It's one of those fun names. I think it's Don John Scale or something. But as I say,
Is it in our chat room?
The link is in the chat room, yes.
All right, let me take a look at it.
Yes, yeah, so basically, the Dan John Brightness Scale. Okay, so on the Dan John Scale of Lunar Eclipse Brightness, L0 is very dark eclipse. The moon is almost invisible, especially at mid-totality. L1 is a dark eclipse, gray or brownish in coloration, and color has a U in it. Details distinguishable only with difficulty. L2 is deep red or rust-colored eclipse, very dark central shadow, while the outer edge of the umbra is relatively bright. L3 is a brick red eclipse. Umbral shadow normally has a bright or yellow rim. And L4 is a very bright copper red or orange eclipse. Umbral shadow has a bluish or very bright rim. Now, I'll also put that into the chat room as well. This is an agreed scale that we have for the eclipse. It's very useful. And yes, you getting pictures of it and getting a visual observation and estimate on the Danjon scale is always useful. And you know what? If you are a member of your association's lunar section, submit your observations. If you're in the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers, submit it. If you're in the British Astronomical Association, submit it. If you're in the American Astronomical Association, the Astronomy Society of the Pacific, they all have lunar sections. The moon is not, as most astronomers say, a boring, we've been there place. It is still changing. We know that micrometeorites are still landing there and they're giving off flashes as they impact. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, it's never really going to be a dead place. And of course, recently, saying this, they have been looking more and more at the theory of how the moon evolved. Mm-hmm. So instead of being the Earth-Theia impact being a brushing impact, they're now to the point where, given the potassium isotopes that have been found in the lunar soil and rocks that have been brought back by the Apollo missions, and I hate to say this, this is proof we actually went there. Okay,
there you go.
The fact that we have these rocks, they are slightly different from Earth rocks, but they have enough, what's the word I'm looking for? There's enough similarity to allow us to say, with, I think, more and more these days, beyond a shred of a doubt, that Theia and the Earth smacked into us fairly central on, and the moon is the result. And if you're an astronomy magazine reader, go to the astronomy.com website. They have a very good write-up on what is the current thinking of this. Now, give me a couple of secs, folks. I'll also grab that link because I just happened to have posted it on my Facebook earlier today.
Good. You can go to what I usually type in is Astronomy Mag in my search engine, and that comes up with Astronomy Magazine.
Yep. So,
yep, that article. I saw that article. Didn't get to read it, but I did see that article.
I had a good look at it during my lunch break today. I was doing other things I needed to do, trying to get ideas for the show. So here's the link. You know what? The interesting thing is the whole theory of the evolution of the moon has really, really changed. It's gone from being a bulge that span off the Earth due to centrifugal force.
I never heard that one. Go ahead.
Well, there was this theory that the Earth was spinning so much faster than it used to, and that a bulge appeared at the equator, and then the bulge grew and grew until it broke away. Well, that I think...
I don't think anybody did the math on that one with the escape velocity and how fast the Earth would have to turn to do that. But,
they
okay.
did. But the thing is, it's like everything else. Science says we have a theory. Then we look at the evidence.
First it starts with a hypothesis.
Yeah, we start with a hypothesis. And then it says, okay, we think the Earth was spinning so fast, a bulge appeared at the equator, and then the mass that became the moon spun off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. As you pointed out, Marty, you would have to work out the escape velocity and how fast the Earth would have to be spinning for that to happen. So that died a death. Then they started talking about the Theia hypothesis, where the Earth was struck a glancing blow. Now, with that one, that would require material from Theia to be encapsulated in material from the Earth. So it'll have an alien core, but an earthly outer crust. That doesn't quite work. The modern evidence says that isn't quite the case. In order for it to have happened the way it is and for the similarities to be there, it has to be a smack-on full hit,
mm-hmm.
which means the Earth went back pretty much into a molten mass.
Yes.
Whatever, and Theia was probably in exactly the same condition. And nobody can actually say where Theia went. So my thought is that the it was being Mars sized, it probably couldn't cope with the actual collision and disintegrated.
Now, I doubt disintegrated, because there should have been enough mass from the system to not disintegrated, but then basically congealed back into the Earth itself.
Quite possibly. We've only really scratched the surface of this planet with with drilling and mining. What we're going to find when we go deeper, I don't really know. Who knows? Maybe we'll actually find direct evidence of the collision. However, we do know that Theia does not exist anymore.
Correct.
Twisted is saying, well, maybe it ended up in Mercury. It could be possible. But, well, Black Projects has made a good case that the core of what's inside the Earth is Theia, because that's why we've got such a huge core. We don't know. It's possible. Until we can actually get down there and sample it, no way we're going to know.
Been a lot of changes in 4 billion years too, though. So even if we could sample deep in, might not give us enough evidence, anyways.
This is true. The Earth is the one thing the Earth is forever rewriting itself.
Mm-hmm.
The liquid state of the core and the state of the rocks that deep, you're not going to have any real past record. This is why, when we are dating rocks, we have to be so careful. Mm-hmm. Now, the Lewison and Genesis series of rocks are so far the oldest known rocks on the planet, and they only exist in a few places now.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is out in the remote islands of Scotland, in the Lewis, hence the name Lewison series. So we have very, very few examples of very early Earth. And to be honest, if the thought about the Theia Earth impact is correct, even they are relatively young compared to what was there first.
I'm actually holding a piece of Costanice in my hand right now.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Earth's oldest rock. Well, one of the oldest.
Well, one of the oldest, yeah.
I don't think it's quite the oldest, but like really, really close. What was I going to say? Glenn was like, "Well, how do we find out about this?" And I think the best way to find out would be more missions and return samples from the moon.
So yeah,
the more rocks we pick up from the moon and analyze them, the more information we'll be able to find out about this.
And you see, really, our exploration is really quite limited.
Mm-hmm.
If the other Apollo missions, if 18, 19, and 20 had gone ahead, they were set to explore other parts of the moon facing us.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we would have had an even better cache of rocks to look at, and perhaps it would have helped form an even better idea of what the moon came from. But unfortunately, the Apollo mission was Kennedy's brainchild.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon was behind a space shuttle, so he wanted to kill off Apollo very, very quickly because he wasn't getting anything out of it politically.
Mm-hmm.
But the space shuttle was his baby, like Gemini, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo was Kennedy's.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we do have to go back to the moon. We have to have a more permanent base, and doing this will allow us to explore and find more of these answers. Maybe somewhere out there on the moon, maybe even on the far side, there is a little remnant of Theia waiting to be discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And that, even finding that will be the greatest boon for us, because our models of the solar system and how planets and moons form are still very early in their evolution.
Yes.
And the more we can understand how the moon formed, the more we can understand how the rest of the solar system works.
Yes.
And of course, the greatest primeval record is out there in the Kuiper and Oort belts. We have pristine material from the early, very early days of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, we have to use radio telescopes and the Hubble to look at star nurseries. Wouldn't it be nice to say we need to do a catch and return mission to, say, the Kuiper or Oort belt to see stuff that has never, ever been contaminated by the inner solar system?
Mm-hmm. Just thinking, wouldn't it be great if we could actually get a sample of this solar system and study it?
It would be brilliant.
No, I'm joking, because that is the same as Earth rocks.
Well, if we can get a sample of the primeval solar system.
Primeval, yes. But I was just joking about if we get a sample of the solar system in general, which means the Earth.
Well, yeah, that does mean the Earth. It also means perhaps bringing material back from Mars.
Or the OSIRIS-REx mission going to...
Yeah, to Bepu.
Asteroid...
Yeah.
Bueno, I think it is, something that Bruno, or I can't remember what it is.
Benupu, Benepo.
Yeah, I don't remember what it is.
Yeah, but you know what?
Launched recently, too.
A few years ago, I was at the Open University for a minor planets and comet section meeting of the British Astronomical Association. In fact, one of my good friends, Richard Miles, who's been on Comet Watch quite a bit recently, he was there, too. And we had Dr. Simon King from the OU, who was in utter rapture over what OSIRIS-REx means. Because we're going to get to see something that we haven't actually had the chance to get up close and personal with. Yes, we've captured dust from the solar wind.
Mm-hmm.
We've thumped a comet with a projectile and measured what comes out of the volatiles using spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually get your hands on a piece of early solar system real estate, not primeval, but early solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Because the asteroid belt's been around there for a long time. A lot of people thought it was a planet that either formed and shattered or never quite formed. I personally don't believe it was a planet that shattered, because in that case it would be in a certain orbit. But it's spread out around the whole of the solar system in a defined orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be good. It's going to be good for science. And maybe this will be the kick in the pants we need to get back out there. SLS is delayed. It's not going to be ready till beyond 2021. Orion is similarly bogged down with delays, again beyond 2021. We need to get our house in order. Mm-hmm. We need to get back out there. We can't always depend on others. And if we're going to go to Mars, if we're going to go to Jupiter or Saturn as a manned mission, it's not going to be one nation that does it. It'll be two or three nations joining together, providing the crew, the equipment, the ship, and everything. Because at the end of the day, to actually explore the solar system as a manned mission is beyond any one country's resources. Even the so-called dictatorships, they could not afford it. The West would need to group together. Everybody kicks in a certain amount of the budget. Yes, as Quart in the Woods says, a kick in the pants to get back out there. China on the moon. Taitong 2 has just been launched, I believe. Taitong 1...
Maybe, okay.
Taitong 1, I believe, suffered the same fate as Skylab in the end. But you know what? At the end of the day, we need a better propulsion system. We need to say, to heck with international rivalries, bury the hatchet, everybody contributes, everybody gets to put people on the mission, and then we can share the science. We can do this. We've done it. Roscoff, ESA, and NASA have got together on space probes. We have the Europeans and NASA getting together to do space missions, to do robotic missions. Why can't we just say, let's all do it together and do a manned mission? We have the people. We have the skills. All we need is the determination and the gumption to say, we can do this. We are going to go to here. We're going to go to here by this time. Kennedy said this. by the end of this decade, we will go to the moon. We will put a man on the moon. We did it. Why? Because it was seen to be a very important national goal. It was a space race. Well, you don't need a space race if everybody's taking part. If China's involved, if the Russians are involved, the Europeans, the Americans, to heck with the space race. It's going to be so important just to get up there, get the job done, and to share what we find. And you know what? There's probably some nice chunks of real estate out there that can be used by industry. Great. That's going to clear a whole mess of stuff that could be a hazard to navigation.
We've got an article that Trista just put in. Yep, China launched its second space station just yesterday.
Yeah.
Tiangong-2.
They are aiming to go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. They've been left behind for so long that they want to get there.
I'd say go for it. It'd be great to have another manned mission to the moon. I think that would be great. Some people say it'll inspire a space race. Good.
Bring it
good
on
for that. If not, whatever. Whatever, but yep, generally I encourage more space exploration any way that we possibly can, as long as you're not crazy.
Yes, that is very much harder. But you know what? We don't have to launch the whole spacecraft from Earth. We can build it in space, and it launches from a space station like the ISS.
Back up a little bit. Glenn was asking about, I think my comment about being a hypothesis. And what a hypothesis is, now in scientific terms, not the general compared science, hypothesis compared to a theory, hypothesis is a general idea. Like, I think the moon formed by magic. Okay, that's a hypothesis. I think the moon formed by, whatever, aliens building it. That's a hypothesis. Now,
Wednesdaydale cheese, that's a hypothesis too.
thinking that the moon formed by a couple body collision near the beginning of the solar system is turning from hypothesis to theory. That means a working science. So, yes, they pretty much proved everything's lining up that there was an early collision between two bodies that formed the moon. Now, there will be variables on the theory that, well, was it a direct collision? Was it an off-center collision? Things like that. Now, that's more of a working theory, which means it's been accepted, and now it's defining it with more evidence. Same thing with, like, evolution. Everybody says, well, evolution's not true, it's just a theory. No, you're saying what you're thinking of, that it's a hypothesis, it's just some idea that somebody came up with. No, theory is a working science. It's been proven. Now it's a matter of continuing the research, and it's all falling in line with the theory. So it's actually a working science, and it actually has been proven.
Yeah, the thing is, Mendeleev proved it with his fruit fly experiment.
Mm-hmm.
He took Darwin's theories and proved it. Mm-hmm. That in over X generations, the fruit flies changed.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that man walked with dinosaurs,
that would be a hypothesis.
Yeah. And that's when we can completely blow out of the water with a torpedo or two.
Yes, because now that hypothesis does not stand up. It's been disproven.
What was that immortal line from Jurassic Park? Dinosaurs go extinct. Man clones dinosaur, gets eaten by dinosaur. Woman inherits the earth. But as I say, the thing is, proving something is different to saying it is this.
Yes.
And that is what science is about. It's saying, this is my hypothesis. This is my facts. My experiment says, oh, I got my facts wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the drawing board.
Yep.
And perhaps the greatest exponent of this was Richard Feynman. He would happily spend hours proving that X was equal to Y, except when Z was minus. But as I say, we need more guys like Richard Feynman. We need guys like Wernher von Braun, who had the vision to go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
we need the commitment to say we want to do this, not just because it's there, but because we have the we can get the technology, we can create the technology, and we can actually give you the technology for other uses. What came from the moon landings? Teflon pans.
They discovered Teflon pans on the moon?
No, Marty. The actual Teflon coating was a spin-off of the space program.
Ah, okay. I just wanted to clarify that. That was another hypothesis of yours.
No, this is a proven fact. It's a spin-off of the space program. The CPU in your mobile smartphone was only able to get that small because NASA said they needed a computer that weighed this and was this size. IBM went away and came up with the first set of processors that ended up with the small piece of technology that's now in your phone. Your cell phone or your smartphone is 100 times more smarter than the computer on board the lunar module. Mm-hmm. That computer has 16K of RAM. 16K. But it was sufficient to do its job. And in the end, it still required a human to make a yes or no decision. And there's a comment that's been said to me without the political part from that era. I totally agree. He originally wanted to build rockets to go into outer space. He didn't want to build weapons, but that was what he was forced to do. And I remember reading one of the journals of the British Interplanetary Society. It comes from the war, and there were three members of the society in a pub, and the first V2 weapon, the V2, the Vengeance Weapon 2, crashed and exploded. And all they could think about was that the space age had actually started. They didn't think of it purely as a weapon. Mm-hmm. They could see the potential for peaceful use. The American government turned a weapon of war into a spacecraft. We actually used a rocket that was designed to deliver a nuclear warhead into Russia. We turned it and used it to put a man into suborbital space. Mm-hmm. We then sent a man into orbit, again, on using a weapon as a weapon, as an item of peace. Now, I've just been corrected. The CPU in your mobile phone is a million times more powerful.
That sounds better.
Yeah. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate that help.
A couple things with our chat room here and watching. So I was going to answer the one. Yes, Barbara Bach is Ringo's wife, and she was in the movie 1 million years BC. No, that was Rucka Watch. That was Rucka Watch. It was another one with Ringo Starr. And Quest for Fire was Radon Chong. Mm-hmm. Was in that one. And by the way, it happens to be halfway through our program right now, local time, 9:34, eastern portion of North America on September the 16th, 2016. And universal time, that would put it at 1:34, September the 17th, 2016. So you've just completed half of our live presentation. And if you missed the first half, you can always catch us on the repeat. We'll repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours.
And the podcast will be available on the website along with the show notes. The show notes will be up pretty much after the show. The podcast is normally pretty much not long after, maybe a couple of hours later, or failing at sometime on Saturday.
Yep. Don't forget, we got more programming coming up, so we do everything in 4-hour blocks. So stick around after this program for more programming. I think we do. Did we get the program lined up? Of our past radio hosts,
yes.
John Schroer, they used to do programs with. It was his birthday just a few days ago, so we're running a rebroadcast of, I think it was me and was it you in that one? Or
all three of us were on the
show.
All three
of us were on that show.
Yeah.
Our good late friend, John Schroer.
We miss John. I have to admit, I do miss John.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful guy. For a long time, he was actually involved with the Planetarium in Detroit, as I remember. Is that correct?
The Planetarium, yes.
Yes.
The Detroit Science Center.
Yeah. So he was so much an advocate of getting people involved in astronomy, in space travel and everything. Mm-hmm. Through his love, not only just astronomy, of amateur radio. And here's an interesting thing for you. If you want to chat to an astronaut, the easiest way to do it today is not with your cell phone, is to find a radio amateur and arrange a contact with the International Space Station. Or even better yet, get your own license. As a technician in the United States, you can own the equipment and aerials to talk to the ISS. Mm-hmm. You can, if normally they have the 2 meter sets on, and if there is an astronaut in the cupola and somebody calling, they will answer. Mm-hmm. Because every astronaut that goes up to the ISS is a radio amateur now. They all have call signs from their own home countries, and they are asked to make as many contacts as possible.
Mm-hmm. And a little note for John. Everybody, take care of your diabetes. It's really important. Follow your regimen. Follow your diet. And check
your blood every time you're supposed to.
Yes. Don't neglect it. It'll catch up to you if you don't.
I do miss him. He was mm-hmm. he was the life and soul. Quite often, he would have a comment that would turn the show completely different to what.
I was going to do this a while ago. Let me give you a little backdrop on what's going on the upcoming week in the sky. Venus will be 3 degrees north of Spica tomorrow, Saturday. Sunday, Uranus will be 3 degrees north of the moon. Sunday, also, the moon's at perigee, which means it's closest to the Earth. We almost had a supermoon. Next Wednesday,
supermoons don't exist, Marty. That's an astrological term.
There you go. We do have a perigee moon on Sunday.
We have a perigee moon.
Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday, next Wednesday, Aldebaran will be 0.2 degrees south of the moon, and there will be an occultation that's somewhere in the world. I'll get to it on Space Pirate Radio and figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
We can see an occultation of Aldebaran in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which will be starting to come up for us Northern Hemisphere observers. We're going to start looking for some winter constellations, Orion, Taurus, Gemini, stuff like that. Unfortunately, down south, people are going to be looking at those as the summer constellations. So, weather changing coming up on September equinox. Next Wednesday, that is. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that on the Wednesday show, what the equinox is, what that means. Northern and southern hemispheres, the same. So keep looking up some interesting skies, full moon observing. Well, hopefully you had a chance to look at that penumbral eclipse, but otherwise the full moon kind of wipes out everything else.
Well, actually, the full moon does have some advantages.
Mm-hmm.
Because with the now, just going to jump back, supermoon, the technical name is perigee synergy of the Earth-Moon-Sun system.
Yes.
Okay, and you can actually get them when they're the furthest away as well.
Yes.
No, but seriously, what is good about the full moon? Well, it gives you a chance to see the Mare in their glory.
If you're farming with an ox in 200, 500 years ago with no power,
you can still see the moon very easily.
You can see the ground during a full moon.
Yeah.
Get more work done.
And, of course, the thing is, it's a very – I wouldn't say it's the best time to start learning your way around the moon. However, it will let you see all the Mare together, and that way you get a good overview. It will also show you at least Tycho and maybe Copernicus, mm-hmm. two very obvious and very easy to find. Yes, you can see crater rays. Now, if you have a moon filter – which is gives you about 13% transmission of light, you'll probably be able to see a little bit more. And don't rush out and buy a telescope. Buy a decent pair of binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they're easy to use. You don't have to set it up every night. If you get really into it, yes, you're going to need something like 20x80s, mm-hmm. and those will need a tripod. Mm-hmm. However, start with a regular pair of binoculars and start with the young moon.
I recommend, if you can afford it, a better pair of regular binoculars. Usually the usual size for binoculars are 7 power, And then the outside lenses will be either 35 or 50 millimeters. So that'll say 7 by 50, 7 by 35. Yeah. But I started out with a very cheap pair of like Tascow binoculars. They're pretty narrow view, but I was able to learn the sky for about 5 years with just binoculars before I got a telescope. Yeah. But after a while with binoculars, I bought a good pair of binoculars. After a while with a telescope, I even bought a better pair of binoculars. I use them both together. My first pair was probably a $20 pair of binoculars in, you know, mid-70s. Now, and 10, 15, 20 years later, I bought a $200 pair of binoculars. Much, much better. But I tested them. I used to happen to work at a store that sold telescopes and binoculars, and I tested each pair for field of view, which is how wide of a view you get, and how sharp the image is near the edge of that field of view. And believe me, spending $200 over $20 was a 10-time improvement in the view through those binoculars.
And, of course, the greatest thing is you can also use them for the planets. Yes. Now, I'm going to recommend a book. I very rarely do this. It's called Touring the Sky with Binoculars by Phil Harrington.
Okay.
It is an excellent book, and there is a web address for a small program that runs even on Windows 10 called Tuba. And that will allow you to actually get an idea of where to look and what to use. Now, the other great thing, of course, is, and I'm going to blow his trumpet for this, is he has a blog on Cloudy Nights of binocular astronomy. And to be honest, it is a very good way to get used to the sky. But perhaps the best thing to ever do and get used to the sky is to buy a decent star chart.
Mm-hmm.
The British Daily Daily Telegraph newspaper did one. Several of the manufacturers do star wheels and stuff. And just to learn your way around the constellations. Because once you've learned your way around the constellations, you can look for things. You can start looking for galaxies, nebulae, and star clusters.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, with 20 by 80, 20 by 50, 20 by 80 binoculars, you can actually see quite a lot of these. You can certainly see the planets, and most definitely see the Galilean satellites of Jupiter.
Yes.
And that, I have to admit, is a very good way. And of course, there was one very famous comet observer, George Alcock, who did everything with a pair of binoculars. He didn't own a telescope. He was a visual observer, and he had quite a few comets to his credit. And they were all found by binocular. And if you get, I will go find a picture whilst we're chatting. In fact, I don't have to, because I've already got a link to it.
I do more of my observing without a go-to computerized telescope, so mostly manually moving around, especially big dobs. I do more observing that way, and I find it absolutely necessary to use binoculars to first find where you want to look, especially if you're in an area devoid of close stars near the object that you want to look for. Mm-hmm. So if it's something new, like a faint comet, it's out there sort of somewhere. Well, I use my binoculars to increase my star hopping ability. I get, because my finder scope is also about the same light gathering ability as a binocular, so it's a 50 millimeter finder scope, so that actually helps me see a couple of magnitudes fainter than my eyes can see, so I can zoom in on a tighter area in the sky. But I have to use the binoculars first to find the star pattern, and then I will use my finder scope to find the same star pattern. Now, it's a little tricky because it can be upside and down and backwards, depending if you have a straight through or a right angle on your finder scope. But I'll find the same star pattern, and then I will be able to zoom in on the area right where it's supposed to be. Now, also, I learned a little trick, too. If you have kind of a bigger telescope, and if you have a Telrad finder, which is similar, there's similar brands to that. Basically, it's a zero-power finder. The Telrad happens to put a bullseye view on the sky. It has zero power, so basically you look along the tube, and it has a bullseye, and you can move your scope over to the spot that you want. Well, I found out with our club telescope, the Telrad is up near the top. I can go back down near the bottom of the telescope, and I can use my pair of binoculars to look through the Telrad and move the scope using binoculars. So I'm actually increasing the power of the Telrad to like 10 power. So instead of a zero power finder, I now have a 10 power finder. Mm-hmm. And I could get the images of, like, I might look, get one of the call it telescopes of the binoculars to look through the Telrad, and the other one get a clear sky so I can get, you know, even better view that way too. But yeah, it's actually, I found it's a great way of looking through a Telrad is by pointing a pair of binoculars through them, moving the scope that way.
Now, I have actually just put a link into the chat room to Phil Harrington's site and to the Tuba program. It is an accompaniment to his book, but you know what? If you are going to start out in astronomy, it is a very good way to start. And I'm going to say this because we really should do all the time. Never, ever look at the sun through binoculars or a telescope.
That's great.
And if you're going to do that, I would recommend that you use projection or use a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And do make sure that you have a proper solar filter attached to the larger of your lens, to your main lenses. Don't put them at the eyepieces.
Yes.
And if you're using beta film, check them every time you use them. Because let's face it, what happens to your eyes afterwards is not worth the risk.
A little clarification on your camera. Make sure you have a filter on your telescope before you hook the camera to the back of
it. Yes, agreed.
Because if you don't, yeah, the sun will actually melt your camera.
Yep, it has happened.
Yes,
in fact, I know some people who were using disposable cameras for solar photography, and it burnt all the way through.
I should do a video on that. You know, hook up a disposable camera to a telescope and point it at the sun unfiltered and just take a video of watching that camera melt pieces and maybe catch fire too.
Yeah.
I have to do that.
Somebody did a very good video of why you should never look at the sun through an eyepiece. And he used pig's eyes for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, yes, it was very graphic. It's very unsettling. But then it's supposed to be.
Did they boil and explode?
Yes.
Cool.
But as I say, this is a warning we're giving you. We do it because we care. I don't want it said that, I did it because Nick and Marty said I should. Don't ever look directly at the sun through binoculars or a telescope. Ever.
We have this recorded, you know, so if you say you heard one thing, we can prove you didn't.
Absolutely. Well, we can prove we said it's not a good idea to do it.
That's right.
And don't use a glass filter at the eyepiece because they will shatter. The screw-in filters should never be used, ever.
Well, let me qualify that slightly. You can use one of those screw-in filters if you just take that filter, hold it up to your eyeball without any telescope, and then look through that filter at the sun.
Actually, I used to use welding glass.
You can do that too.
Yeah. Welding glass is very, very good, particularly for eclipses or for partial eclipses of the sun. However, it is still a better idea just to fork out a few dollars for a proper piece of solar filter material and use that. Mm-hmm. Always play safe with your eyes. Don't ever observe the sun directly through a telescope with them.
And if you think we said something different, we will say, yeah, in a pig's eye.
Ooh, bad one, Marty. But apt, but apt.
There you go.
Now, of course, the nicest thing about this time of year, for me, it means that Orion is rising in the skies. And that means I get to try and go and image my favorite object, for a deep sky object at least.
Yeah, but it also means cold weather for us here in the Northern Hemisphere.
So what, Marty?
I could do forever summer. I'm sorry. I'm just that kind of person. Okay, I really would prefer forever fall, but that's – I have to be nomadic to do that, which I could handle that too. But I don't really care that much for the winter times, even though I try to play out in the snow when I can, but nah.
Well, that's why you set your telescope to be ran from your living room, your bedroom, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be nice and warm. You can have a nice relaxing cup of tea or cup of coffee or a nice glass of wine or something as you image. And let's face it, going to the dark side and imaging is always fun. And this time of year, for me, it is M45 and it's trapezium. I love trying to image the trapezium.
Tough to do for a visual star hopping observer, though.
Yeah. But see, the other thing is, if you don't want to use digital cameras or film, you can sketch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a very good friend of mine in the United Kingdom, Paul Abel, he was using the Griffith Observatory telescopes, and he's been sketching Mars recently. Mm. And of course, yes, Glenn, the sisters are back, the Pleiades are back. You've got Cassiopeia as well. There's just so many lovely, lovely constellations which return to us in the autumn and winter.
Yep. We're going to lose most of the planets, though. Jupiter's about gone. Saturn, Mars, low to our south here in the northern hemisphere. So we're going to start losing those. Well, plus they're also getting into the sunlight, too. So that's, we're going to start losing that. About the only planet that's actually coming around the early part of the evening now is Venus.
Yeah.
Getting higher and higher in the west every night. So we'll get Venus for quite a long time, but we're going to lose all the other big planets.
But they'll be back next year. And well, you know what the greatest thing about Venus is? Venus shows phases. It shows them through binoculars and through a reasonable sized telescope. And you can actually sit and have fun at sketching the phases of Venus. You can take photographs of the phases of Venus.
Quite easily. It's really bright.
And of course, this is where, as an amateur astronomer, you can have a really good laugh. Because there's bound to be somebody who's going to call into your local radio station and say, there's a bright object in the sky, and it's following me.
Exactly.
And you can call in and act as smug as can be. Oh, that's the planet Venus. It's not a UFO. It's not ET coming. It's the planet Venus. And then, of course, you can really show off and display your knowledge of the skies. Uranus and Neptune, yes, they are available in the skies.
Yeah, and they're coming around more, too. So, in fact, right now, looks like Uranus has risen about a half hour ago, something like that. Yeah, what constellation is that in? Let me see. I can figure it out. Looks like pretty close to Aries. What's on the other side of Aries? Pisces. Uranus is in Pisces, looks like.
So you've not only have you got Uranus and Neptune coming, you've got Pisces, Aries, you've got Orion, particularly in the early mornings in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Something there for everybody. And you know what? If you want to go out, this is a good test of how dark your skies are. How many stars can you see in Orion? And I think we've got the night that particular event coming up soon as well, haven't we, Marty? Or have we missed it this year?
I don't know.
Because once a year, the Great Star Watch happens, and they ask you to tell how many stars you can see. And a lot of people, including the organizers, use Orion because it is a very prominent constellation. Some people can see more, some people see less. But that's sometimes just down to eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
And the other Pleiades, things...
Pleiades, too.
Yeah. There's not just the seven sisters there that we know.
My younger eyes used to see a whole lot more. I know at least 11 stars, maybe 13, 14 stars in the Pleiades. And now I'm mostly down to about 7, 8-ish, something like that. So my eyes are definitely diminishing.
And, of course, another naked eye object, but this is more in very dark areas, is M31, the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yes.
And you can make it out. It is a very fuzzy object, but it is there. Again, it is a good test of eyesight, and it's also a good test of how dark your skies are. I do recommend trying it. Please do. And come and talk to us. Tell us how well it went for you.
I have even seen in really good dark skies, not that long ago, too, so my diminishing eyes, M33.
Mm-hmm.
There were some incredible skies that night. Yeah. And then the globular clusters, M13 and Hercules, M92 and Hercules. I've seen naked eye. There's some interesting stuff you can see naked eye. In fact, Uranus, definitely back in my younger days, I have seen the planet Uranus naked eye. It was right on the edge of vision, but I definitely did see it.
Yeah. So people say, oh, it's winter, what do we do? Go out, go look at the skies. There's the Orion meteor shower coming up as well. Mm-hmm. Have an evening out. Have a family event. Take some deck loungers, deck chairs, call them what you like. go somewhere nice, nice dark skies, put them up, set them so you can see a lot of the sky, but don't look directly for it. Use averted vision, because you'll see more that way. And look towards the radiant, which is in the constellation of Orion, and see how many you can get. It does take a while. It's going to be at least 30 minutes before your eyes are dark adapted enough. And if it's a nice night, you're going to have a lot of fun just counting how many you see. So
go ahead.
Possibilities.
I got to put a picture in our chat room here. I want you to check this one out. Something unusual I discovered about this. This is a recent Hubble telescope picture. It is of called a lenticular galaxy. It's in our chat room. Go ahead, pop it up.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah,
isn't it lovely? Okay.
Lovely. Click
on it, magnify it, and then look in the upper left-hand corner of that same picture. Mm-hmm. Roll on over there. There's a galaxy with a triangle of blue giant stars in it. Perfect triangle.
It's an asterism.
An asterism of blue giant stars and galaxies. Isn't that amazing? Can you see it?
Yeah, I can.
I can't. Yeah, well, it's like never seen. That's got to get out there somewhere. I'll see what I can do about putting it out somewhere. But that is actually amazing. So you can go to the NASA website, and it'll tell you about the Hubble's latest telescope, latest image. It's a lenticular galaxy. Look in the upper left-hand corner of a real small spiral galaxy. It's got a perfect triangle of blue giant stars in it. It's amazing.
Now, I actually got an email from the European Space Observatory, the Southern European Observatory.
Okay.
And it's called Starving Black Hole Returns Brilliant Galaxy to the Shadows. I'll just put the link into chat. Now, I got this during the day. Yes, if you're friends with me on Facebook, you will have already seen it. But you know what? A lot of people don't see things.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. That's in the chat room. And as I say, it is an awesome story. The mystery is of a rare change in the behavior of a supermassive black hole.
Yes, I've got that article too.
Yeah. I'm very lucky. I've still got a student account with them, so I get tons of email.
This one I've got is from SciTech Daily, this article.
Yeah.
It's interesting is that black holes can be kind of seen when they have a lot of stuff falling in them. So galaxies that are really far away are fairly young galaxies, and they can be very active. They can have some x-rays coming out of them, depending on how much stuff falls in them and how they fall in them. And this one has actually been, they've actually seen it over a period of 10 years, and that's really a very, very short time in universe time. They've actually been seeing this black hole getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And they kind of figured out why it's actually getting that way. Go ahead, read the article for more details. But they've actually been witnessing a black hole getting dimmer. And there's another article, too, which I didn't get there, about how they think they've actually seen a black hole forming.
Interesting. And, of course, John's put a link into chat for us about string theory, string inflation triangles. And, of course, also the latest edition of Science in School, issue 37 from ESO, is out. Right, okay.
Next Friday I'll put the article on how they've seen a black hole form. They think.
Okay, great. You know what? We are living in momentous time. Okay, we've been told to start the wrap up. So
yeah.
I have been looking forward to doing this all week. Are you ready?
Right.
Hang on. I hope you all heard that. I'm going to say this. There's 3 people to beam up. We're down to the last 15 minutes. I said I would do this. Second. I have done it.
All right, everybody. Really appreciate you listening in tonight. I appreciate everybody in our chat room. Time for us to get out here. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website, It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts. AFM.